Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to discuss Nigerian political parties and the labeling of the major parties, APC and PDP, as terrorist organizations by a Canadian court. I'm joined by a very special guest, Mr. Jai Gaskia. Mr. Gaskia is a public affairs and political commentator and analyst, among many other things. He's a professor of practice at the University of the Oppressed, Nigeria. He's the co-convener of the Campaign for Transformative Governance, Nigeria, and former chair, National Steering Committee on the Partnership Against Violent Extremism, PAVE. He was the presidential aspirant for the 2019 general election under the Sustainable National Party and a former delegate to the 2014 National Conference in Nigeria. It is a pleasure to have you join us today, and I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the platform. Thank you so much.
Brilliant. Let's start off. So a couple of, I think recently, a federal court in Canada treating the case, I think Douglas Garavi and versus Canada, declared the Action People's Congress and the ruling party in Nigeria and the opposition PDP as terrorist organizations. How true is this to begin with, and what is the circumstances surrounding this and the implications of such?
There's been quite a lot of misconception and misunderstanding with respect to this particular court case and the ruling itself. I think that so the first things to clarify is that really when you go through the judgment itself of the federal high court of a federal court in Canada, you would see that the court made a determination with respect to some certain acts and actions of in particularly the People's Democratic Party, the PDP, and which under Canadian law, some of those actions also fall under terrorist actions. So, for example, a subversion of democracy, and so on and so forth. And the essence of the ruling really was about a case that was brought by this Mr. Douglas, who was actually seeking political asylum and was claiming, but it was rejected. His application was rejected, and so he appealed it. And his application was rejected on the basis of the fact that that he was a member of the PDP, and that during the time frame during the 2007 general elections, in that period, that some of the actions of the PDP of PDP agents, like ballot snatching, election violence, which the court attributed to PDP, that those actions were amounted to subversion of democracy. But the court did not make any determination on whether the party was a terrorist organization, because that wasn't the issue at stake. So it wasn't, so the court could not have made a determination on an issue that was not brought before it. It simply just made a determination on those stats, because the grounds on which Mr. Douglas was denied was that he belonged to that he participated in terrorist he took terrorist action and belonged to a terrorist organization. So yeah, and he appealed that. So they made a ruling on that. The other thing also is also the fact that so some of the reports that have come out have talked about the two main parties in Nigeria, and this is what I actually then find very strange, even with the ruling. So which also begs the question: what kind of evidence and facts did Mr. Douglas provide, and then what kind of what process did the first the arbitration panel and then the court, what process did they undertake to sift through those evidence. So for instance, there was a reference to that same period of time between two. There was a reference to that period between the year 2000 and the year 2006. There was a reference to some political people's congress. We also now note that the case in question related to a period between 2000 and 2006. Even at that period, there was no party that was called All People's Congress. There was the APP, All People's Party, but there was no All People's Congress. There was no party with the acronym of APC at that time. And the current ruling party, the All Progressive Congress, did not also emerge until 2013, 2014, and so could not have been the party that was referred to. So that's where I said there were also some misconception in terms of the ruling, but also I think it also fact of the evidence adduced to even by the court itself, because a simple check of Nigeria's party registration history would have simply shown that there was no such party with that acronym during the time that was referenced in the case.
Thanks for clarifying this, because like Riley said, there's been a lot of misinterpretation and a lot of stories, narratives that I love, even some learned people have just promoted. But this makes it clear. But then again, like you rightly said, this also brings to fore whether the burden of proof is on the applicant, whether it's on Mr. Douglas to prove this, or whether the court also has a duty to process, like Riley said, the evidence that is brought to verify this, because that would be an indictment on the court in terms of what processes has it undertaken to make sure to protect his own integrity. But whether we like it or not, we can say this is an individual case. It also points to a wider problem in terms of how Canada sees Nigeria. We can add another incident where Canada had denied some senior officials visa to go to Nigeria. So could you say that Canada is, in a way, making a statement to criminalize the political elite or the political leadership or the elite in Nigeria? Do you think that there is a systematic...
Okay, so it's not clear what is whether this is systematic or not at the moment, but it does, like you rightly said, point to it can be an indication really to what we can say is a mindset of the Canadian system, and maybe also even a pointer to a consensus amongst Canadian political elites with respect to their Nigerian counterpart, but also because there has been quite a number of pressure, really, where you also see it back home in Nigeria. Some of the conversations, really, among civil society and among citizens have also been that those who known to be, or at least widely perceived to be, implicated in undermining the democratic process in Nigeria, should not be rewarded with travels and so on and so forth. Given the fact of the appetite of Nigeria's political elite for also visiting these capitals,
Let me share my personal opinion, then I'll ask you your personal opinion. You being a staunch civil society leader, and your opinion. So my opinion, I've always been, in looking at the complicity of especially the West, in how, on one hand, I'll say the hypocrisy of the West, where it's promoting liberal democracy, and on the other hand, either turning a blind eye to the corruption of the African political elites, or corruption in terms of, like, we see what happened with the Abacha loot. It was all in the Western banks. And see what's happening with the leaders that come to seek stuff. So I've always said personally that rather than criminalize ordinary African citizens that are running to Africa, you know, running away from the poverty, from the conflict that, you know, the actions of these leaders are creating, they should stop the political elites from coming for medical tourism. They should stop them from putting money in there and all of that. So what is, and you really see also that the civil society, or ordinary people in Nigeria, welcome this, even though we can say, oh, this is an interference in another sovereign state, but they welcome this. What do you think? Do you think this is a victory in that fight of civil society or ordinary people into making their leaders accountable? Do you see that as a step towards that?
Well, it could be, in the sense that first, in the sense that this kind of a situation, because when we talk about legal precedents now, so this is a ruling of a court now, but this particular individual is really not representative of that political elite in that sense, but it could be a test case so that you can have a legal precedence now to use in more prominent cases in future. So that's possible, because again, when we go back to our earlier conversation, because this was an application for asylum, the burden of proof, though, on Douglas, but also it was also expected that they would have made their own verifications in order to be able to then make an appropriate determination in this case. And it does seem that they turned a blind eye to doing that. So probably because of what we are talking about. But then what you also said is true. But yeah, in terms of the fact that the people that the West should really be targeting these political elites. Mm. But unfortunately, they are also the people that the West cannot target. And this is also because the West is, like you said, the West is very complicit in the crimes that these people commit. They are also the beneficiaries, actually, of the crime. Yeah, so it's a bit difficult for them to then go after people who essentially are their benefactors because of the things that, you know.
So, Good. That's what I was saying. We had a podcast yesterday, and we were talking about Trump's immigration policy, and the guest was somewhat biased towards the American stuff, and I wanted to point him towards seeing how the leaders in Africa, that you can't separate their action from the global actions, from the action of the West. Absolutely. It's kind of intertwined. Sorry to call you short.
No. I mean, absolutely. There's absolutely no way we can separate some of those things.
Has Nigeria responded? Has there been any official response from Nigeria?
No, actually. Okay, yes, there has been. I think there was a senior special, somebody from the presidency, I think responded just to make those clarifications in terms of that this judgment was not referencing the All Progressive Congress, which is the ruling party. But even in that, their clarification, they also mentioned the fact that that there was actually also no determination against the PDP. But I mean, it was those actions. So yes, at least they tried to set the record straight, but I don't think they gave it any prominence. It just was something that just came out. So again, that's also probably an indication even of their own something in terms of, this is routine. This is normal. Let's just move on.
But looking at 2027 is approaching, and we've started seeing all the, you know, scheming and all of that. How has all the opposition parties, have they capitalized on this? And is this going to be a dent on APC and PDP as we move towards 2027?
I don't think it's going to be a dent on the APC, because I mean the APC can make that case and make it very well. I mean, of course, in terms that this was not a reference to it, but I also don't think that the opposition is going to capitalize, because I mean if the opposition was going to use this, they would have started using it. But essentially, because the opposition, I think that amongst them right now, they understood actually the kernel of the ruling, and that so if they were to use it, then they would actually be indicting themselves, because all the opposition, there's nobody playing politics prominently in Nigeria today, with the possible exception of those who are formerly in the CPC, and then those who are in Action Congress. With the possible exception of those, there's nobody playing politics today that has not been in the PDP. So it's a bit difficult for this new emerging coalition to try to then make some mileage out of this, because then they are all complicit in this, and the social media is definitely not going to be is not going to grant them immunity, you know, from brushing them with the same tag if they were to use it. So I think that they've been careful to avoid it.
Speaking of political parties, we've seen in Africa, we've seen in some African states, especially the Francophone African states, we see some kind of recession or regression in democracy, and see the rise of the military. And not just that alone, we see popular support for those in Burkina Faso and all of that. And we've also seen like the Trump administration now having some kind of transactional relationship with this so-called authoritarian government. And then we look at Nigeria, we look at the last elections, and look at where we're going, and look at how political parties if we look at the ruling and see what's based on our normal stuff, the ballot boxing, the vote buying, intimidation, oppression. Do you think this will have any, do you think all of this will have a change, will have an impact in changing how political party or political parties politics works? Are people going to start galvanizing around issues, ideology, or will it be business as usual as we approach in 2027? Also looking at how political parties are forming, I think it's the ADC recently that is forming, and all of that, you know, scheming that is going on. What do you think all of this is going to have an impact on these political parties' politics?
Okay, so, you know, the normal expectation would be that there should be some impact, you know, on all of these. But I think that Nigeria's political class has also proven to be very impervious to external stimuli, to criticism, and that's already seen even in the conversations that are going on now. Even in the formation of the ADC, what has been very prominent, there has been no conversation really about the main issues and about envisioning a different pathway for Nigeria. That's also why that coalition has not generated any such interest and momentum amongst those that should, really, because the fate of Africa's democracy is actually really and global democracy is in the hands of the younger generations right now. This is a very this is an aggrieved generation. This is a generation that feels very isolated, very or unsupported, that feels and that is very angry. And it's therefore moved by anger, and oftentimes by anger alone, and not by knowledge, not by and it's why you see what that as people, as citizens, as citizen descent increases, you can also see that that dissent is actually moving in a direction that is laying the foundations for authoritarianism. Because you can see the shift where, so rather than dissent, deepening dissent, deepening democracy and democratic contestation is actually it's actually undermining democracy in broad terms, because even the conversations in amongst these mobilizations and of anger, of grievance, they are also essentially also echo chambers, intolerant of dissenting views, very toxic relationships, and that's why that's why that base can find the appeal and the allure of a populist autocrat, you know, very something that they might support until things then change. But so for me, that's the biggest danger that I see with what is happening across Africa. And why in some of these other countries, particularly the Francophone country, because also of this particular case of French colonial history, all the attempts at assimilation, and also the fact that the French neocolonialism was more naked in the Francophone space than say in the Anglophone space, in terms of even the linkages of the economies, the linkages of the central banks, the treasuries, and the rest of that. And so that provided a base for rousing, and mobilizing national patriotism and national populism. The danger with bigger countries like Nigeria, Kenya, and the rest of that is because these countries are also very large and very diverse, and also, you know, ethnically diverse, religiously diverse, and so we cannot rule out the kind of things that happened that is happening across the Sahel in West Africa in terms of military activism, or even an attempt for an authoritarian consolidation. But the challenge with that is that in a country like Nigeria, in a country like Kenya, in those bigger countries that are more diverse, it is most like such a thing is most likely going to degenerate into a civil war. I mean, Sudan is there for us to see. It's most likely going to degenerate into a civil war. And so you're going to have that for a while before things begin to settle down.
Go on.
No, I was just saying that, and for me, this is actually why informed interventions are necessary, you know, in all these conversations and in all these mobilizations at the moment. So it's not that we should stop mobilizing or that we should stop mobilizing dissent. It's that we should ground the mobilization in ideas, in programs, in alternatives, rather than in phrases and slogans.
Okay, this is our response to it. So I agree with most of what you said, and the evidence is there that we've seen the rise of populism, the rise of authoritarianism in places like Burkina Faso. We've seen in Cameroon, we've seen in Ivory Coast, where you see leaders that are, you know, nearing the end of life, you know, still being there forever. In Cameroon, we have Paul Biya has been there forever in agriculture. And we see the frustration with the youth. And we see how that is creating tension. We see the protests in Kenya, in Mozambique, in South Africa, and all of these places. But then again, there's a mixed, it might be very few, there's mixed reaction. We see in Senegal how with all of that, it didn't turn into authoritarianism. It turned into something a bit positive. Though we can say this is rather few what we're seeing with Senegal, we're having the youngest president in Senegal. That could be like an indication, okay, there's some hope for the youth. But in the last election in Nigeria, we see a mass turning up of the youth to come to vote. And that was dashed. And we've seen also the progression, the NSAS, and all of these protests that are leading to this. And you would know that in every protest, I know you know you're versed in this, you know, being the protest, even in our own democracy, how all of this resulted into the kind of democracy we have today. So the question then would be, how can we ground, how can we help to consolidate and ground those dissenting voice, those youth frustration, how can we channel them in a positive way to challenge? Because the status quo was really challenged with the last election.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we take it moving from there to the point where we can have positive? And I'll let you respond by responding to the unfortunate death of the activist that was murdered in America, Charlie Kirk, the 31-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And they say he was single-handedly responsible for garnering the huge vote for Trump. So how can that happen in the case of Nigeria, for instance?
Yes. So one of the things, again, so one of the things that I've been doing a lot these days, every time I've had the opportunity to speak to speak with and interact with the young activists, is to also say that to ask the question perhaps what we need to start posing, the question that the younger generation should start posing, is the question of the first question is what kind of Nigeria do we want? So what kind of Nigeria do we want, and what kind of Nigerian citizenship do we want to see? What kind of and then pose that question, and then also articulate and aggregate demands that are political and economic in that sense. Part of the challenge with the younger generation, which every generation that is trying to emerge from the shadows of older generations, is always the initial struggle with charting a path and finding the correct path. I think that's the role that some of us need to try to play to help to guide into those directions without taking those spaces, just help to guide, you know. It's like, can we sit down? Can we reflect? We've had answers. We've had bad governance in Nigeria. In Kenya, we had the Gen Z protest twice. Can we sit down and reflect now and say, okay, so yes, we've done this, and we know that we have the ability and the power to actually challenge the status quo. Okay, but then what are our demands, and what do we need to do? And then start organizing in the sense of actually establishing organizations, not organizing to mobilize. Because organizing to mobilize usually does not allow us time. When that's the only thing that we are doing, it doesn't allow us time to reflect. And it doesn't allow us to build the strength that we actually need, the capacity that we need. And then to start believing more in them. Because I also see that part of the challenge with the younger generation right now, again, is every generation faces that challenge, is also the fact that is this idea that when you are trying to chart a part out of this darkness, of looking outside of yourselves for the leaders and for the saviors. And so at the end of the day, what happens is that you then evolve and create a messianic figure that then becomes a monster eventually. So it's important. So I keep telling them, I say to them, I say, ask yourself these questions. You've organized this way. Some of you are running businesses. Some of you are already doing this. I mean, why do you think that you cannot run this country yourselves? Why do you, why do you think that you need somebody else to do that? Why do you think that you can't run this country? So if you then pose the question that way and you challenge yourself that way, so if you challenge yourself that, look, that we can govern, and so you will then start asking yourself, what do we need to govern? What would we need to govern? And then you will start finding out that you need to put those things in place. And it's a challenge that even civil society in general also faces. So civil society engages with governance, okay? But engages with governance to influence, to critique. And so, and then you have that problem when you then see civil society activists that then become politicians or political. They then take that same attitude into politics. And yet they have never asked the question, they've never asked themselves the question throughout their years of activism. They've never asked themselves the question, what would it take to govern Nigeria? If power was to fall into our hands today, how would we govern Nigeria? So if you don't pose the question of power and you don't pose it in that way, then we're going to be faced with all of these things. And so there will be a vacuum that is created. And then all manner of messiahs can feel.
Let me ask you this question. As someone that has tried to straddle that divide, you being a presidential aspirant in the last two elections, trying to, what was that experience like for you?
Very, very revealing. Eye-opening. So, revealing and eye-opening. Not necessarily with the political class, because I know the political class, and I wasn't open to build around the political class, but eye-opening and revealing, particularly amongst activists. So for me, it was that community that was the most eye-opening and revealing for me. It just struck me the lesson that I took from there. From that is that those who are most invested in challenging the rot that is going on in pushing Nigeria towards a different a more transformative path, they are also least invested in the understanding of power and in actually organizing for power. So unless you then bridge that divide, that gap, unless you do that, I found out that many of the things that we say and that civil society activists say amount to just slogans, because if you make that transition, you want to go to the other side, and you want to go to the side of governance. The question is, how do you translate this slogan into a program and into a service that is delivered? How do you transform that? And usually that's where we are short. So people have not really given wide thoughts to that. And you know, and I think it's also that's the challenge with our political system and with the way our parties are structured, particularly this side of the world. Because that's where those conversations are supposed to be held in political parties. Yeah. Essentially, every governance policy is first a policy of a party. Yeah. It's first discussed in a party and all of that. But that doesn't happen here. And those of us who are challenging that are also not doing that enough in the structures and institutions that we have set up to challenge this. So there's a vacuum. So at the end of the day, there is bad governance, but we are confronting bad governance with slogans. And these slogans then become seized upon by smart elements in the political class. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then we are where we are today. So
it can all be bleak, because we've also seen where Like I said, why the majority of it might be like that. We've seen some movements as well. Yeah, we've seen not too young to vote.
Yeah.
We've seen where young I've forgotten some other ones. Enough is enough. We've seen some of these enough things which enough, sound which sounds rather than some which sound more like activism rather than you know, channeling, structuring the platform that provides a credible program ideology that challenges this. So let's say, with your experience overall, let's come to a conclusion and say overall. So I'll put this question so that you can conclude with this. So what is your, looking at the Nigerian, let's even start from the Fourth Republic and say, okay, this is the longest we've had. What do you see? Do you have hope that this will, that there's going to be, because we've had progress as well. You know, yeah, we can't discount that.
Absolutely.
So what do you see moving forward in the, let's give it 10 years. What do you see moving forward? And how do you think we can have that change? I know you started alluding to some of those things we need to do. What do you think needs to be done to get to where we need to get to our full potential?
Yeah. So the first thing is, let me start with that point you made about progress. You know, I say this a lot because sometimes we also beat ourselves too much. People like yourself, like myself, in this space, you know, we even the younger generation, and that's why the younger generation does not also see the progress that has been made, because we've not. There has been no attempt to actually construct a narrative that is critical of the present, but very accommodative of the progress that has been made, and that attributes that progress to the activism that has been happening. You know, so we need to construct that kind of a holistic narrative, so that people can know that yes, we are challenging this system. We need to challenge this system because it's failing us. But that progress has been made, and that progress was also made because other people also challenged the system, so that what we are also now doing now, we also lead to progress because we need to have that kind of a continuum of a narrative. That's the way we can actually make that's where transformation can happen. That's where we can make the transition. So I think that part of our first task really is to contribute to the development of that kind of narrative, critical, progressive, but also that shows what we have done. So I've posed these questions to many. I said, just imagine that we were not doing all the things that we were doing. Imagine where Nigeria or Africa would have been today. If all of those things had not been done, if all those steps, all those challenges had not been mounted, imagine where we would be today. If there was no resource control struggle in the Niger Delta, imagine where the Niger Delta would be today. If there was no muscle, imagine where that the situation would have been today. If there was no pro-democracy movement, imagine where Nigeria would have been today. So that then tells us that that organizing can lead to success. And so now that leads me to the second part of the question that you asked. In 5-10 years time, I think that there is a huge potential for us to actually make it, because what 2023 showed very clearly is that a challenge can be mounted and mounted successfully against the status quo. Now the lesson that we need to draw from that is that we must build our own resources so that we are not reliant on other people. So there were two or three things, for example, structurally faulty with the 2023 challenge. It's not just that, and that's the same thing the opposition is doing now. It's not just that the vehicle, we outsourced the vehicle, Labour Party. We outsourced the face and the leadership of that movement, Obi. By no stretch of the imagination were either of these two a part of the movement, a part of the challenge to the status quo. So they had their limitations in terms of how far they could take the movement. Mm. And let's go back into history. In the independence period, remember the Zikist movement, Mokugu Okoye and the rest of them. But also remember, almost exactly the same. It was as if history was repeating itself. Mm. But Zik denied the Zikists at the end of the way because it became too radical for him. In this case, I think that the obedient movement found a leader that could not provide leadership, and that was the biggest challenge because for him, the movement was a brand that elevated his own personal interest. He did not become integrated with that movement. He did not take ownership of the movement. He did not then give it leadership. So in the sense of, so I will give you, and it's unfortunate that it's even older people now. So look at the Gen Z's in Kenya. And look at the way the Gen Z's still turn to Raila Odinga. And that when he speaks, it's somehow, but that's because Raila has inserted himself. So we need to build structures, and we need to build collective leaderships of that kind. But more importantly, we need to build and develop that narrative, because it's the only narrative that can lead us to victory. To say that, look, we're on the right path. And this is our history. We've had successes, we've had failures, we've had challenges, but we've had real successes. And everything that has happened in Nigeria with Nigeria's progress, really, let's be honest with ourselves. It is despite and in spite of Nigeria's leadership. It's not because of them. It's not because of something that they did, with the possible exception of the leadership in the years of a self-government. Between 1852 and 1960, because that same leadership that made all of those transformational moves during self-government messed things up in the First Republic. But with the possible exception of that period, and you can say that's the period of our greatness. When we talk about the good old days, everything, even the mantra of Nigeria's giant of Africa, came from that period. First in Africa, first that came from that period. So we need to build. So for me, that's what we need to do.
Let me just comment on this, then I conclude. You see what you said, without, talking personally. I agree with you 100%. And I've said that even if Jesus Christ, if they come and put Jesus Christ as, with the kind of structure we have in Nigeria,
It will not work.
So the problem with Nigeria is a problem where imposition of constitution, which is external to us, imposition of leaders on a there's nothing that is emanating from the ground, the struggle from the ground. There's something you said that I've in my book. I don't know if you've seen my last book that I wrote in 2023 by Routledge. It's called Nigerian's Fourth Republic, a Militarized Democracy. Where I've looked at education as a key to it. You mentioned it as well. We need to orientation. Yeah. We need to educate the people and create a narrative and create that passion and all of that. And let me conclude with what you said about Obi. I've always said, when a system relies on an individual,
absolutely,
it doesn't. A system should be able to on its own survive. There should be institutions regardless of an individual. So that savior mentality, that messiah mentality, we not work. So I agree with you. It's all about the structures. It's all about creating an institution that works. And I know your work, and I know you've been doing some brilliant work. And we can hope, but again, with people like you and the things that have been done, like as you've highlighted, we must solve this. We've seen there's progress, even though there are also elements, unscrupulous elements, that are also benefiting from the road and creating the road, we've also seen progress. And I want to remain hopeful. But I'm very, very grateful for your rich insights. Thanks for your understanding of the situation and rescheduling of this. And I'm really grateful. And I would see you. I was hoping to come to Nigeria in October, but I'll come in February.
And, good.
I'll make time and I'll come and see you and we'll talk. But I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. Have a brilliant day.
Thank you for
thanks.
Thank
you. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in today. As usual, join me to thank our guest, Mr. Jai Gaskia, for his very into the political dynamics in Nigeria and the saga or the situation surrounding the Canadian court's ruling of the political parties, major political parties in Nigeria. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.